talking about what's really going on if it doesn't mesh with our knowledge of space-time. And here I'm talking about general relativity, even more so than special relativity. We have this entire field that tells us a lot about reality to a lot of physicists. And if we're going to claim that we're not at least the non-relativistic flat space limit of something compatible with that, we're not talking about reality. And the problem is, you take the little standard, the standard interpretation, and you try to extrapolate it upward into the relativistic and general relativistic limit, and you run into all sorts of known problems. And what this tells me is that we're starting with the wrong thing, or there would be a path upward, or maybe it's the right thing, we just don't know what the path is, and we just haven't thought of the right way to extrapolate it up. But there's an alternative, and the alternative is, instead of completely ignoring it and hoping one day, a couple hundred years from now, we'll figure it all out, we could just start with something that we know is extendable to GR and take the non-relativistic flat space limit of it and hunt around in the math and look for something that looks like quantum mechanics. So basically, we know how to take the non-relativistic flat space limit of these things, and by doing so, we can leave a rope to help pull us back up once we have something we're happy with and get back up to something closer to the ultimate theory. So that's the plan of attack. Basically, strip away all the complications. Stripping away charge, in particular, I think is critical to this line of thinking. If you don't strip away charge, you run into some interesting problems. So let's get down to the basics. Let's get down to boring old spinless neutral particles. Let's even start with no potentials. For reasons I'll talk about in a sec, I am going to start with classical field equations, and more importantly, classical measurement theory on those classical fields, and just hunt around in the flat space limit for something that looks like quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So that's the plan. And why do I want to start with classical fields? I guess you might say they're the closest thing to quantum field theory that we know is compatible with GR. And actually, if you look in relativistic quantum mechanics and to some extent quantum field theory, when you're looking for a neutral spinless particle, you're looking at a real classical field, not an operator value field like in quantum field theory. I just want a real, like, electric potential that has numbers, real numbers, not complex numbers, everywhere in space-time. And I know how to do this. There's a Lagrangian density that corresponds to such a field. Notice that there is only one free parameter here. We're used to, from the non-relativistic perspective, have m and h bar come into different places. And when you start here, that's not true. You just have one free parameter. You parse it up according to de Broglie's relations. And basically, by postulating the mass, you get h bar for free just from unitary analysis. Then you extremize the action, and subject to one complication I will mention, you get the Klein-Gordon equation, which is probably a good thing, right? You're all thinking, oh, the Schrodinger equation, let's take the relativistic generalization and get the Klein-Gordon equation. But then you might scratch your head and say, wait a second, shouldn't that be the complex Klein-Gordon equation? And here I have a real scalar field. So what gives with that? Why don't we want to map quantum mechanics to a complex scalar field? Well, just a little math here. Those of you thinking I'm playing games with omegas, I'm just defining this to be the frequency that solves the dispersion relation. And you'll see this omega not a lot. This is the rest mass, the Compton frequency. And if you look at the complex Klein-Gordon equation in flat space, and only in flat space can you do this, you pick a foliation, and you can break this up into basically two complex functions in three-dimensional k-space, and that tells you all of the solutions to the complex Klein-Gordon equation is defined by two complex functions in k-space. The real Klein-Gordon equation, on the other hand, you can split it up the same way, but when you do that, you get one complex function. This is real, this is complex, but you add in the complex conjugate again to force it back to real. And that, of course, looks a lot closer to the single particle Schrodinger equation, which, again, only has one complex function in three-dimensional k-space. And there are a lot of very, very similar analogies between these two equations. This is the single particle real space Schrodinger equation that could exist in real space. I'm not talking about multiparticles. Yeah. Now, you might say, wait a second. Wow, what you do up here is you do use the convex Klein-Gordon equation, but we drop one of those terms. Well, right away, you're in danger because you can't split it apart in general relativity. So if you're going to be saying, ah, these terms are somehow ontically different from these terms, you're right away causing trouble. But first of all, remember, we are, one argument is that those are negative energy terms, but this is a classical field. There is no such thing as a negative energy classical field. Another argument is those are antimatter terms. Remember, we stripped away charge. There are no antimatter terms here. There are no terms to drop if you start here in the classical field. And the math, therefore, is a lot more natural here. Really, the only difference is in the non-relativistic limit is there's this additional e to the minus I omega naught t, which is k-independent. That's the Compton frequency oscillation. And you have to add in the complex conjugate. So you say, well, let's just compare these two equations. It's a pretty easy map between these two objects in space-time. And there it is. Probably never seen that equation, but it just follows naturally out of this analysis. Basically, it says in the flat space-time limit, if there's this candidate ontic field here, we can sort of assign quasi-ontic status to this psi because it tells us in the limit what our ontic structure really is. There's this one-to-one map in the non-relativistic limit. Now, why have you probably never seen that equation? Well, for one thing, I just want to point out again, you can only do this map in flat space-time, so we shouldn't think that our notions of what the psi are going to extend all the way up to GR to do that, but we have a lifeline now, right? We cut over here, and this we know how to extend up through the relativistic Lagrangian density. More interestingly, you look at this, and you see, wait a second, this is just the real part of this first term, which means the overall phase of this psi object is suddenly important, or it's suddenly, apparently, if I'm claiming that's ontic, it's seeming that this overall phase is ontic. So this is something new that's come out of this analysis. However, it's only significant if you can measure the timescales on order of the Compton frequency, which even for an electron is like 10 to the minus 21 seconds or something. So, but we this is our sort of first inclination. Maybe, well, we've just always viewed this global phase as a totally meaningless quantity. Maybe it's just an immeasurable quantity. So already you see by breaking outside of the quantum formalism and coming back at it, there's the possibility at least to have some new stuff. what about potentials? The typical thinking, well, we've got to add terms. We've got to add some sort of interaction term to the Lagrangian. But there's a way to do it without adding any terms. It's already built in. We have this metric. And we know how to do gravitational potentials. It turns out you can just look at the Klein-Gordon equation with zero potential in curved space-time for arbitrary potential. You look up the solutions. You can find the WKB limit of those solutions in the literature and use this map. And presto, they match the Schrodinger equation solution in that same limit. So all of a sudden now we have a way to add back in potential without any of this nasty antimatter stuff that might occur if you just added an interaction potential. More cool results. Well, let's do some measurements on this classical field. How do you measure a classical field? Well, the classical stress energy tensor of the field gives you the measurable parameters. So I'm interested in the energy density. I take this T naught naught with suitable foliation, and I'm looking for the energy density of the field. It looks like this. Now, in the non-relativistic limit, this middle term here is negligible. And I just use my map. I know this is the real part of that. You take a time derivative, and it's totally dominated by this super fast Compton frequency oscillation. And now you have the imaginary part. You plug these in, and this is not a postulate. This is classical field theory. But it's giving me a hint that, well, maybe this map is telling me something about quantum mechanics here. Now, this isn't a Born rule. This is not a probabilistic rule. But you could argue it's like the infinite, the way Maxwell's equations are infinite photon limit for QED, you could argue, well, maybe this equation is like the infinite identical particle limit, where you can have a continuous spread of energy density if you have enough particles. So don't think of it as a one-particle equation. Maybe that's been another mistake coming up from the ground floor. Maybe we should think of it more as an infinite particle equation and whittle down to one particle at some other point. What else can we do? We can get the momentum density. That term looks nicer, but you plug in that same map, and using these definitions, you end up with this mess, which doesn't look very promising until you realize that this omega naught t in all these terms is this totally unmeasurable phase because of the super high frequency of this oscillation. So even though there's ontic importance to what that phase is, you can say, well, I can't ever measure it, so I'm just going to average out over those timescales. And presto, I get something. I get the probability current. I get the J sub I just simply by averaging out over this now important phase. And I say, OK, I can't measure it. And look, we have this form of this conserved four-current structure that you may have heard is not present in the real Klein-Gordon equation, and yet here it is. How do people not find this? Well, first of all, it's not exact. You have to average it. And secondly, they were looking for an exactly conserved four vector. But now that we have our lifeline to the GR world, we can pull up and see, wait a second, this conserved probability current in the world of non-relativistic quantum mechanics doesn't correspond to a four vector. It corresponds to four components of a 4x4 tensor, something you may never have thought of if you were trying to build your way up, but just sort of falls out of the analysis on the way down. Okay, well, what else can you do? Can you quantize anything? These are two quick view graphs for a much longer talk I gave here in June. If you're interested, you can look that up. But basically, I just went back to classical action principles. And I said, well, classical action is supposed to extremize my action. What if that's always true, no matter what kind of measurement I make? Are there any constraints on the boundary conditions I impose? When you do action extremization in force space, you need a closed hypersurface boundary condition. And if those boundary conditions correspond to measurements, as I'll argue later they do, then you could say maybe there's certain measurements that wouldn't allow an extremized action. And sure enough, if you try to make this thing zero, you have to have this zero, and that's the Euler-Lagrange equation, that's where the Klein-Gordon equation comes from. But you also get this annoying boundary term. Normally what you say, well, let's just fix the fields on the boundary everywhere, and therefore they can't vary, and the boundary term goes to zero. But I just showed you an example of a measurement, the T00, that's not a function of the field, this is also a function of phi dot. And now, if you fix the energy density, you make an energy density measurement for an initial measurement here, you're not fixing phi on the surface. And the only way to make the zero is to make the normal field derivative zero on the boundary, which is this weird constraint on this action minimization. It's basically telling me there's certain measurements that have a preferred shape hypersurface. Let me show you a little picture here. In the non-relativistic limit, what happens is you can define this local group velocity, and you basically get this oscillation at the Compton frequency, as I was asking. This is time now. What that condition tells me is that if I make a measurement, it has to be, the normal derivative has to be zero on the hypersurface. So basically, it's telling me I need to be on one of these crests or one of these troughs. And you work through the analysis, and pretty quickly, you discover something that actually looks almost exactly like Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. This is not a velocity. This is this defined via the stress energy tensor now. But a consistency condition on action minimization, now you're coming out with something that looks a lot like the old quantum theory, which I am very excited about and is on the archive now. And you can go see the full talk as well. OK, great. I've quantized maybe energy, maybe angular momentum. Maybe I have this infinite particle limit. But this still doesn't look anything like quantum mechanics. For one thing, actually, the previous argument hurts me in the sense that it gives me a lot of information about my measurement. Knowing the shape of my hypersurface actually effectively gives me all the Cauchy data. I can solve this as an initial boundary problem. The good news, to counteract that, is this is a distinction Rob taught me, is that even though there's no uncertainty in what you know, there's still indeterminacy in the sense that there is no such thing as a well-defined energy, localized energy density and localized momentum space simply because of the Fourier transform properties of this field. You get the uncertainty principle for free if anytime you're in a field ontology. So there is an indeterminacy, but I still know everything. So why is there probability? This is still supposedly an infinite particle limit. How do I whittle down my acceptable boundary conditions and tell me I'm only allowed to measure a few particles? And all the other problems. Why, if we know everything, why is there probability? Where do all these other features of quantum mechanics come from? It looks like a hopeless case. But here's the thing. What's the simplest possible extension of this? You just add another scalar component. You don't even have to have them interact. So this is the next thing to look at, right? Okay, I didn't get quantum mechanics. Let's try one more. I was motivated this summer talking to Rob about his toy field theory. And he basically has these two vacuum states and two one-particle states. So I said, well, let's make them indistinguishable. Let's just add another scalar field that you can't tell the difference. And now I have two ontic scalar fields. I can use the same map to map onto two things that look like one-particle Schrodinger equations. And they both solve the Schrodinger equation. But now what happens if I measure this? I go back, I do the same sort of analysis on the measurement properties, and now I add up the probability densities of the two fields to find the total measured probability density. So if I was going to deduce what the wave function was, all I knew was this is my energy density, I might mistakenly deduce that this psi measured is my wave function. And similarly, by looking at the probability currents, which also add up linearly, I might use these two equations, my measured values here, to deduce what my wave function is. From these two values, I could determine it within a global phase. But now, thanks to the nonlinearity here, even though these two guys solved the Schrodinger equation, because of this nonlinear map, this guy doesn't solve the Schrodinger equation anymore. I'm actually, turn out, I'm using the wrong equation to move forward my guess of what the wave function is in time. Now, this is maybe starting to sound a little bit like Yakir's talk from yesterday. I'm not at that yet. I have to deal with the fact that I don't even have enough boundary conditions anymore to solve this thing. Now, I think a better question to ask might be, what sort of problem do you usually expect not to have enough initial conditions to solve? And as I was talking earlier, I'm really focused on action extremization here. It's a classical, nice classical picture that applies to classical fields. And it's not this picture. This is the picture that Lee Smolin calls a Newtonian schema that we consider classical physics, where we start with initial boundary conditions and propagate things forward. But there's this other perfectly good schema. And the question is, should we take it seriously? Should we take it seriously that really we only know partial information on this surface and then partial information on that surface, and then we extremize the action and get the same laws of physics? They're not the same picture, I would argue, because even though they do get the same laws of physics, they have different boundary conditions. What is a boundary condition on a physical system? Well, it's a physical constraint. If I want to constrain a system, I need to reach in there and do it. So I go in there and physically constrain a system. And how do I do that? I interact with it. And that's why I call measurements boundary conditions. Basically, anytime you're interacting with the system, you're effectively constraining it, or at least finding out, if you like to think of it that way, what the properties are. But there's a symmetry there. But regardless, these boundary conditions are ontic. I want you to think of these things as ontic structures in their own right. These measurement results are real. If you think of it that way, now the picture you heard yesterday from Yakir about his two-state wave function actually maps into this. What he was proposing originally was that, okay, say we have two states. He didn't quite come out and say he thought these were ontic, but I'm going to go that extra step. Let's say these are two ontic fields here. He has his history vector psi 1 and his destiny vector psi 2. He's imposing these boundary conditions on this two-state wave function. Now, I thought this was a little funny that, well, if both of these states are really here all this time, why would you just measure one of them? So I started playing around with this picture. I think really this is just isomorphic to what he did and still have two different boundaries. I think the big step forward was when I moved up to the complex Klein-Gordon field. And I'm not going to go through what I did in this paper, but the whole point was I now got a symmetric rule. Whatever rule I used for this boundary, I used for this boundary. So I managed to symmetrize it. But it was just a guess. How do I impose a boundary condition? I didn't have a map. Now I have a map. Now I know how to do it. So I haven't even written this up yet. But this is how one would correctly do this on a complex Klein-Gordon field. You'd use the map I described earlier to go down to two ontic wave functions in the non-relativistic limit. Use this kind of map, where it's a nonlinear combination at each boundary, and solve the intermediate equation. So here's my psi epistemic model. This is how it works. You can do this even if you don't know any relativistic field theory. This is all straightforward quantum field equations, because it's a non-relativistic limit. So I'm calling these fields ontic, even though they're really maps to my actual ontic field. They solve the Schrodinger equation. From each of them, you can develop a current, a four current. You add those two four currents, and you get a measured four current from which you deduce your quantum state. Now, at this point, it's actually not epistemic by Rob's definition. But remember, this quantum state, that doesn't obey the Schrodinger equation. So as I time evolve that guess state forward, I have a computed wave function, and it doesn't match up in the middle because I'm using the wrong time evolution equation. And so I get all the way to the end, I make my final measurement, and lo and behold, my computed wave function doesn't match up with what I see. Oh my goodness, there's been a collapse. No, just like in the psi epistemic theories, you update your knowledge using usual Bayesian logic, and even though everything is perfectly continuous on this side, you see strange things happening on your epistemic side. That's the model. The promising thing is that you can get more than just the ordinary psi-epistemic model, because you now have this future constraint. Think of this as the second surface on your action integral, constraining when you extremize the action. What you're doing is determining these ontic parameters. So basically, the type of measurement that you perform at this final time and the results are a boundary constraint on these ontic parameters, which basically gives, that's contextuality, right? What else is contextuality if not that? In fact, if these are hidden variables, which they are, you now have a perfectly valid way to violate Bell's inequality simply by saying, well, now they're in part dependent on what's going to happen to them in the future. There's an open mathematical question I'm looking for some brains to help me on, which is how do you actually take these measured data and go back and reconstruct what actually happened. This is a retrodiction problem. Doesn't help with prediction, but it's certainly an important retrodiction problem. The other point, since I'm just about out of time here, I've now explained why there's probability, because we're using the wrong equation of motion, but I still haven't told you what that probability is, and we still need a rule. I think the natural structure for this probability we need to postulate in such a time-symmetric looking model is going to be a joint probability distribution as the fundamental object from which you could generate conditional probabilities. I have a really good guess, which is what they use in quantum field theory, which is the classical action. And that's what I have, the classical action. So that's a good guess. Another one is like my other Klein-Gordon paper, where you look at the solution space of ontic states and see how big is that solution space. And there's some function of solution space that maybe will give you the right probability as well. I need to add more particles. But the nice thing about these two-time boundary problems, another nice thing, is that you don't need to expand into configuration space. Your psi-epistemic state may very well need to expand into configuration space to deal with all of the possible outcomes you could do on all these different particles. But the ontic state is constrained by the actual next measurement. It's constrained by the measurement that actually happens and doesn't need to encode all this wasted information that we never use in configuration space of all these measurements that never really do happen. Your epistemic state may certainly need to take that into account, and you would expect to see that in the structure of the theory, but you would not need to expand your ontic state for identical particles. You add a new field, you'll have to expand it there for sure. Whether they're testable experimental consequences, I don't know, but if I had to tell an experimentalist where to look, I would tell them to try to correlate the as precisely measured time between their measurements as possible with the outcomes and look for strange correlations, because that is the key parameter in this, exactly how far apart are your measurements. So I'm just going to leave these up here, although I guess for Rob, I need to say psi-epistemic models and action extremization are deeply linked, I believe. And maybe I'll just leave on the note that simple classical models constrained by a global classical action, all classical physics, are yielding this rich, coherent picture with all the essential features of quantum theory. The quantum formalism is a box. I mean, it may be interesting on the inside, and there's a lot to discover in it, but we need to break out of it. Or Chris Fuchs is going to be here when he's AD complaining about sitting through another damn Quantum Foundations conference. if we're going to get outside the box, it's only from outside that we can look back at the box and see that we've been trapped on this unitarily evolving Hilbert space. And it's only then that we're going to be able to see the advantages of really treating time and space on an equal footing. And hopefully, everything will look a lot nicer. Thanks.
Ken, I know I've talked with you about this before, but I find that I'm not quite clear on it. So I wonder if you could address this question about how you're thinking about measurements. In the limited framework you gave, you just have a linear field with no interactions. I believe right. You want to talk about measurements as some sort of interactions.
Right.
It's still not clear to me how a particular kind of a particular interaction is supposed to pick out what we would think of as a particular basis in the Hilbert space. So maybe you could say something a little more about that. I know you didn't have time to go into all this.
In classical field theory, if I measured If I measure the energy, you calculate T naught naught. I'm measuring the combination of psi squared plus psi dot squared. If I measure the momentum, I'm now, in classical field theory, measuring the product of psi and d psi dx, or psi dot and d psi dx. So the type of measurement you do constrains your parameters. So now I have some constrained parameters for my initial measurement. And then I do another measurement. My lab is outside my system, of course. You don't want your lab inside your system. And then you constrain other parameters. And then you do action extremization with whatever parameters your measurements happen to constrain. There's my picture. There are external boundary conditions on the constrained system, on the field. Well, in this toy candidate epistemic model I suggested, I would, since I don't have the way to whittle down from infinite particle limit to one particle limit, I would use the tools of ordinary quantum measurement theory to analyze that model. But I want to get rid of operators. I want operators don't work on these surfaces. And if that picture at the bottom there is at all telling, we need to make measurements. We often do make measurements on these surfaces. It's called a stationary detector, right? If you can make a position measurement on a surface like this, you can make a time measurement on a surface like that. But we don't have a time operator because operators don't work on surfaces like that. We need to break out of the operator formalism and have a more general measurement theory on such surfaces.
Can you say something about what you mean by point three up there?
To me, because of point two, psi epistemic models are pointing to action extremization problems. And action extremization problems have future boundary conditions. And future boundary conditions allow you to violate Bell inequalities. That's what I'm thinking. I promised Chris I would. Well, okay. There's a lot of semantic parsing I don't want to get into. If I'm constraining this system and this system depends on it as a result, I treat in a block universe framework, everything is there. You just solve. It's just math. Maybe I should let the philosopher speak to whether it's retrocausation or introcausation or something else.
Okay, we thank the speaker again.